everybody. Libby Hellman with Second Sunday Books, and I'm coming to you from Chicago. And tonight I have a very special guest, Cara Black, who is a mystery author who sets all of her mysteries in Paris. And she has just come out with her 19th novel. It's called Murder in Bel Air, which is in the 12th arrondissement. And she can tell you how she moves around between arrondissements for each book. And some of you know that Cara and I are good friends, so this is going to be a fun interview. I'm really glad you're here, Cara. Thanks.
Oh, thanks for having me, Libby. And yeah, it's really exciting because yesterday was the launch day of Murder in Bel Air, and tomorrow I hit the road on book tour, and I really wish that you were with me because we've done book tours in the past and had a lot of fun.
I know. We're going to have to do another, you know, well, I'm working on something. So if and when it comes out, I'll make sure that we can do some stuff together. Before we get started, I just have a little housekeeping to do. Actually, listeners, you are listening to this on June 9th, which happens to be the second Sunday of the month. So for once, we're absolutely on target. And I do need to tell you that this is a trademarked, copyrighted podcast solely owned by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Okay, Cara, tell us about Murder in Bel Air.
Well, it's set in 1999, and you know, when I go to Paris, I'm very, very lucky. Over the years, I've been able to stay with my Parisian friends who are so, you know, give me so much hospitality, and they're generous and they're tolerant and patient. And that's the reason I can stay there.
Can I stay with them?
Yeah. You know, they lend me a couch, an apartment, you know, if I cat sit, a bedroom. And one of these friends is Madame Gerbeau. And Madame Gerbeau is the mother of my French neighbor here in San Francisco. And I have stayed with her. And it was really came to me when I was staying with her that in this very peaceful kind of bucolic part of the 12th arrondissement in Bel Air, where she lives, that it had been the former hunting grounds of the kings, and that it was the site of the guillotine that killed, executed the most people of all the guillotines in Paris during the revolution.
Really? I thought the guillotine was down by the prison.
Oh, it was. And they moved it because they said the stink of the bodies, you know, bothered the aristocrats.
So is there a lot of parkland and forest in the arrondissement?
It used to be outside the Paris city walls. And this was the Paris city walls from the 13th century until, you know, the mid-19th century. It used to be countryside, villages, you know, green spaces, vineyards, and the site of abbeys run by very powerful abbesses who were no stranger to court intrigue. There were monasteries and abbeys. And it was a very different kind of place. There's even a street that still exists with the 13th century name of Rue de Bièvre du Loup, Brèche au Loup, I'm sorry, and which literally translates to the Street of the Breach of Wolves.
Ooh.
And it's still there. And there is the narrowest and smallest street in Paris there, which is 2 feet by 9 inches across. It's amazing.
Wow.
And of course, yeah, it's just, so you find these vestiges of the, you know, countryside in the past. And it's still there. And what I realized also was that at the Place de la Nation, which was formerly called the Place du Trône, you can still see the old toll gate houses and where the guillotine was. And there, when they set up the guillotine between June and July 1794, I think I have, or something, or 1798, the revolution, that they would execute the victims, throw them in a wooden cart, and take them a few minutes away to a convent that they had taken over from the church, mm-hmm. and they just built pits and threw the victims inside, the headless victims.
And did they bury them or
eventually? In a big mass grave? Yeah.
Is it still there?
Yes. Yes, 1,306 victims.
Oh, my God.
And their names are engraved on a small chapel that's right there on the wall. And you see all their names. And it's just tragic. You have, you know, the names, the profession, and their age. Like Marie, aged 18, laundress. Mm-hmm. And then you have a priest. And just this, you know, melange of different people. And also many aristocrats. Mm-hmm. So what happened afterwards when Napoleon got power, the aristocrats and nobles exhumed their relatives. I don't know how they did that or could identify them, and bought this small plot of land adjoining where the mass grave is, and they made a private cemetery where it's called the Cemetery Picpus. And when you go there, you will see them, and only people who are descendants of these aristocrats can be buried there. But we would know one, which is the Marquise de Lafayette, who helped us in the revolution.
Right.
And an American flag was flying there, and it was flew there during the Second World War. The Germans allowed it because of their respect. And so that's just fascinating. And mm-hmm. it really, my Madame Gerbeau's balcony overlooks this kind of very symbolic place.
Really?
And so I knew this would be great to set a story here.
Okay. So how does the story fit with the environment?
Well, right away, Libby, we have a murder, and we have a murder in the Cemetery Picpus, so mm-hmm. There's no spoilers there. It happens on page 2. So, and so that's a big part of the story. I really wanted to bring that out. And
as I recall, Amy's, Chloe, that's Amy's daughter, goes to daycare there. Why would Amy, who lives, near Notre Dame, go all the way over to the 12th for daycare?
Well, for sure. And Amy's mother, Sydney LeDuc, her American mother, who's on the Interpol wanted list, had insisted that Chloe, who's 10 months old, go to this special art enrichment program, and, was just insistent and said she would take her, and it's participatory. And Amy is like, oh, it's so far away. And then she didn't know why her mother had insisted on it. And then, of course, she's just about to give this big PowerPoint presentation with all these CEOs of La Startup, and then
for the few people that don't know who Amy is, can you give us a real quick summary of who she is and what she does?
Sure. She is half American, half French. Her American mother, who does feature a little bit in this book, is a former terrorist, she supposes. And her father was a French policeman who was drummed out of the force and went to join his father at LeDuc Detective, which Aimé LeDuc has taken over, turned it from criminal to computer security. And she lives on the Ile Saint-Louis, mm-hmm. In a beautiful townhouse that I would love to live in. And mm-hmm. So she runs it. Her daughter, she manages, as any single mother does, juggling. And, she has a wonderful nanny. But, of course, it's like any mother, and I know you and I have had this experience on the road, when a child calls and you're in the middle of a book tour and nobody picked me up, panic sets in. So I really pulled on that and put that in the story. It's like your worst nightmare, right, as a parent?
Right,
you're
exactly.
Miles away, and then no one's there to pick up your child. So, And so that's where Amy is when the story starts. And she's got to go to this place. And, of course, her daughter, because her mother did not participate, her daughter is, kicked out of this pretentious playgroup. And anyway, so that's where the story starts.
Yeah.
And at the time, also, I just wanted to mention, my friend Laurence, a French journalist, had gone to live in the Côte d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast.
Yes.
Which is when the time my story was set, 99, was still considered the French jewel, you know, the jewel in the former French colonies of Africa. It had a stable government. It had great business opportunities. French people loved to, you know, there's easy access from Paris. They could jet down for holidays. You know, it was very desirable and stable.
But it wasn't. However, it was independent, correct?
It was independent. And it had gotten its independence in the 60s from De Gaulle. But of course, there was a lot of French business there. So, but it was, you know, everyone felt safe going there apart, you know, mm-hmm. from the other parts of Africa. Yet, my friend Laurent's saying it's not as rosy as that. So that really intrigued me. And in the real time, at that time, when my story takes place, a coup d'etat was brewing. And it actually occurred, a coup d'etat, in December, Christmas Day of 1999. So I could draw on that because it was very current. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it reflects in the story.
So tell us a little bit of what happens, because I know the beginning is really dramatic.
Yeah. Well, Amy gets pulled into this because her mother has not picked up her daughter at the playgroup, and her mother does not answer her phone. Her mother has disappeared, and she's...
So how many books did we have to wait to see Sydney, to actually see Sydney have a part in the stories? I mean, Amy was always longing for her mother, but we never saw her until what, book 12 or something?
Book 13, we see her. That's the prequel where Amy's mother and Amy's father actually are together briefly mm-hmm. in Berlin. So that was a real, but in the past. In the last book, Amy and her mother actually have interaction, and Sydney plays kind of a big role at the end of the story because she's wanted to get back in Amy's life because of her granddaughter, Chloe.
Right.
So, but of course, she's not, as Amy says, some women should just not be mothers. So.
Or grandmothers, right?
Or grandmothers. So right. They have a very problematic relationship trying to get to know each other. And Amy feels like there's that Chinese saying, you know, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
So now she has her mother who is not domestic at all. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So Amy is about to give this really important speech, right?
And right.
Then she finds out the mother didn't come. So she has to, what does she do about the speech?
She has her rival volunteers, of course, to take over. And what can she do? So she has to leave and hope that she can get back later for the evening apéros, you know, and network and, you know, keep these contacts. It's a great chance for her. She's been on bed rest from a concussion in the last book, and she's practiced this. She's got her strategy lined up to get new business. And, of course, it's all shot down. Right. And she's going to come back and try and salvage this. But she goes to the playgroup, picks up her daughter, and they go next door to the cafe where, you know, to get milk for Chloe's bottle so Amy can have an espresso and figure out her next step. And then the waiter comes, now I've seen three generations of the family. And she goes, what? She goes, yes, your mother comes here. I recognize your darling baby, and I see good genes in your family. And Amy's kind of flattered. But then he goes, yes, you know, we were hoping she would come today with her friend. And Amy said, what? Yes, her friend, that homeless woman. And she's so, you know, generous. She has such a Christian spirit. And Amy's going, what? Her mother? Taking a homeless woman here with her daughter, you know? And so all this kind of unfolded. Did her mother have this Christian side to her? She didn't really know her mother. And as they're finally leaving, they're about to leave. She has milk for the bottle, and she's going to push her in. They're going to take the bus or go, you know, with the stroller. It's nice out. And one of the waitresses rushes in all upset because she says that, she has seen this woman, a young homeless woman who was knifed to death right across the street in the convent grounds. And Amy is going, and And Amy goes, and it turns out to be the woman that Amy's mother was always treating to coffee after the program.
Of course it was.
So we go from there. So a whole story unravels. Mm-hmm. And it turns out this young woman was Cote d'Ivoirean. And we get some very high political stakes here. And I really loved researching about the French manipulations in the colonies and after the 60s of the French former French colonies, because de Gaulle and his shadow minister who very much orchestrated things in the background. So
wow.
I also spoke with a man who worked with the UN who told me about his time in Liberia, in Cote d'Ivoire, and about that time and about how so much was under the radar.
Mm-hmm. You are known for your complicated plots, and not in a bad way, but there's always something going on. Why is that important to you?
Well, I think, for me, writing about Paris and about this time, it's a special time, and I think I need to reflect what's going on in the world. But mm-hmm. I think Aimée Le Duc herself does computer security, but she is wired to do criminal investigation. She is a licensed PI, but that, now with a child and to keep, finances going, she's got to always do this boring corporate work.
Right.
So she would be pulled or, be, for whatever reason, she gets involved in, and she has a whole network of police who she kind of grew up with because her father was a policeman and, they would come in, as a single father, he raised her, they'd sit around the kitchen table playing poker. And, she sort of imbibed that and understands the police as much as she resents them for closing ranks against her father.
True. Yeah.
So she has this push and pull. But I think it's really important. A lot was going on in Paris. A lot was going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And in Paris, there's always the surface and then the undercurrents. Mm-hmm. Which can bring this other subplot in that's quite important.
What subplot is that?
Well, in this story, it's just the knifing of a homeless woman is like peeling an onion because we find out it relates to the coup d'etat in the Cote d'Ivoire. What was happening here is Amy's mother a rogue or not rogue CIA? Is she sort of contract CIA in Paris?
Yeah.
And is she working with this woman, and why has her mother disappeared, and why won't her mother contact her? And then when Amy tries to follow up and find out from the convent nuns about, her mother, she's trailed because of the people who, were looking for the homeless woman. Anyway, so it sort of spirals out. And I like to read that kind of story. And, so that's what I write.
Yeah. I mean, you and I have spent hours on the phone brainstorming each other's plots, and you are always going for the next obstacle, the next wall, the next thing that's going to throw Amy off track, or the other characters too. The other characters come up against a brick wall, or and it's amazing. You just keep on going, and it's all credible. The amazing thing is that it all works,
Thank you. Yeah, well, I when I go to Paris and I research, I take the fleeks, the cops, which is not pejorative, out to dinner and for wine, and I start pouring and I start saying, what do you think about this idea? Or would this have happened? Or what? And now that it's 20 years I've been doing this, and a lot of these, several of them have retired and worked in the 90s, so they can tell me things. They're much more looser. Mm-hmm. I'm not getting state secrets, but a lot of times they will suggest something and say, no, we wouldn't have done that, or this is really what was happening, or, and it's great because I can use of course, I fictionalize it, and I really don't put in anything they don't want me to. I try to be discreet, but a lot of these plot points were suggested by police who say, this is what was going on, this is how we would have done it, or this branch had no communication with the other branch, sadly, which was very true at that time. Their computers system didn't even connect.
Well, Well, that's kind 90s. Of like here in the U.S., the same thing. I think that the same thing is probably still. I wonder if the 17, 8, you know, intelligence agencies here have a way to communicate with each other. They probably don't.
Right. And, you know, this was all before 9/11. This was before the terrorist attacks in Paris. So we're almost in an innocent time, if you will. You know, there people weren't texting. I mean, there wasn't, you know, the GPS was only the French military had it. You know, things were just a bit slower. And I like the fact that if Aimee wants information, she's got to go talk to someone. She's got to dig. She's got to, you know, interact with people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it develops her character. Not that she doesn't do a lot of computer work. But, you know, it's about the people, right? It's about the characters.
Absolutely. What characters do you feel are, I don't know, unique or different in Bel Air?
I think that, I think Renee gets a you know, quite a bit of page time in the story. And we see him in a very dogged mode. And there's trouble with his beautiful classic Citroën car. So it was really great that Renee would have a lot more going on investigation-wise, and we understand why. And I think there's a lot of innuendo about Aimee's relationship with the biological father of her child, mm-hmm. Chloe's father, and we don't really know what's happening in that. So it was fun to explore that.
Yeah, I think the last line was pretty funny. The last line of the book was great.
Okay, but no spoilers.
No. You just have to read it. So you go to Paris twice a year, and you go and you walk, you say you walk the streets and you walk the streets and you walk the streets. Do you take notes on things that you hear or see or feel or taste?
Of course. I take notes. I record now on my phone, take photos. I do all of that. I meet people. And what was really funny I just got back a week ago. I had met a man, he's a chemical engineer in charge of the fire department, fire investigations at the laboratory of the police central laboratory in Paris. And I had met him the last visit and just was hoping to meet him again. And he said, sure. And we met for lunch. He picked, and now this is kind of a French macho policeman chemist. Mm-hmm. He picked a restaurant in the Left Bank that was gluten-free and vegan, okay? And we met there. I was so surprised. And, you know, Paris is changing. And he told me he was in charge of the fire investigation at Notre Dame.
Really?
And so it was amazing. And he said, of course, he couldn't say much because it's an ongoing investigation, but he showed me photos when he first went inside Notre Dame, you know, with the team and, you know, the rubble and what happened, what was the amazing things that were left. I think many of us have seen the pictures, you know, the stained glass window was left. But the way he was talking about how they conduct the investigation was fascinating. Then he started telling me about another case. And he was like, you should use that in your book, not the one in Notre Dame. And I went like, what a great idea.
Kind of running out of arrondissement now because there's only 20 and you're on book 19.
Okay, I confess I made a mistake. I set two stories in the fourth arrondissement, which is Murder on Ile Saint-Louis and Murder in the Marais, my first book.
Yeah.
So someone pointed that out to me in Paris and said, you've done two here. And I'm like, oh, you're right. So I have to do 21 now.
Okay. So then what happens after 21?
Well, you know, there's crime in Marseille. I went there last year and I loved it. I loved Marseille.
Yeah, I like Marseille too. I mean, I've only been once and that was a long, long time ago. But, who is it? Chris Reich just wrote a book, not his current book, but the one before. A lot of it took place, I think most of it took place in Marseille. It was great.
Yeah, it's just, you know, the French Connection, the beautiful, you know, heat, and, you know, it's just gorgeous. It's got so much going on. It's hard to pick one thing.
Right.
I was lucky. I got to have a tour of the Panier, which is the old part where they filmed the beginning scenes of the French Connection, you know, really run down. It's
In Marseille.
In Marseille, in this area. And he, you know, he was a French crime writer and he grew up there and he was telling me all these things. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
So
now what's next for you?
Well, I'm taking a break from Émile Le Duc next year and I have a historical thriller that should be coming out in March.
Oh my God. This March of 2020?
Yeah.
Oh my God. It's coming really soon, Cara. That's amazing.
I know. It's kind of scary for having written 19 books in the series. It's a real scary thing, but I think it's great. My editor really wanted me to do it. She said, you need a challenge. And I said, okay.
What's the name? What's the title going to be?
The tentative title is 3 Hours in Paris.
Love it. That's great. That's terrific. It really is a good story. Cara.
Thank you. It's different. It's set in the first 2 weeks in June 1940, the first 2 weeks of the German occupation of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I can say.
Tell us a little bit about the difference between writing a standalone and writing series.
Well, this has been my first time, Libby, as you know, and it's been scary. It's been, I know you've done, you know, standalones. We talked about it. William Kent Kruger, who's our friend and who we've traveled with, told me that I should do it. He encouraged me. So a lot of people said, yeah, you know, let the fear fall away and dive into this story, develop this character in a different way, which I did. So that was different because I needed to let Aimee go, a fictional character I've been intimate with for about 25 years.
Yeah.
That's
a big deal.
It's a big deal for me. I know many people who we came up with have done a lot of standalones, but so I just have jumped in and I hope it works and people like it. I think it's very different.
I think
of course, set in Paris, so that's good. Yeah.
I don't know about you, but whenever I write a standalone, I find it really freeing, liberating, because I'm not tied to either Georgia or Ellie, you know, and I don't have to deal with their, you know, make things consistent. I can just start from scratch and do a brand new slate of characters, brand new scenes, brand new settings. And I find that kind of liberating.
You know, I found that too. And it was liberating and scary. It's kind of like giving myself permission as I was writing to go somewhere else.
Right.
Which was good. It was really great.
Right.
So
you're going on tour. Where are you going? So people can hear and make sure they come to your events.
Sure, I'm doing one event tonight here, finishing the Northern California at Copperfields in Santa Rosa. Tomorrow I go to Seattle. I'm doing a book gala, library book gala at the Bastille Cafe. I'm doing several libraries in the Seattle area. Then I'm flying to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and doing the mystery bookstore there in conversation with Kit Kruger in another bookstore. Then I go to Madison, Wisconsin, a wonderful mystery bookstore there. Then to Milwaukee, to Boswell's, and hopefully see John and Ruth Jordan, who run Crime Spree magazine, our friends. Then down to, where do I go? Then I go to Poison Pen in Scottsdale, Arizona, then over to L.A., do several events in the L.A. area over the weekend, and then off to come home, and then I go off to New York and then North Carolina.
Wow.
And then I think in July I get to go to Washington, D.C. at Politics and Prose and be in conversation with Sujata Massey.
Right.
Who, you know, and love her new book, was her second in
the... Yeah, it's getting great reviews.
Yeah.
But so is your book. Your book is getting terrific reviews, and including by the time, listeners, that you listen to this, there will have been a New York Times review, right?
Right, this Sunday, yes, New York Times review.
Great.
So, yeah, check it out.
Yeah, there was one more thing I wanted to say. Oh, the trips to Paris. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. I've been going with this woman. We did book trips with Politics and Prose. We did them with a Book Passage here in California. But now we're doing them with Donna, who you can find her at Best Friend in Paris. And Donna and I do Amy Leduc trips. We're doing one. I just did one in May, doing one in October. And we go to sites in my stories. We'll actually go to Bel Air in the next trip. And then we're going to go visit Amy's apartment, it's been very difficult, but we got permission.
Oh, great.
So that's a big thing. But we do, you know, we go to places in my books. And then you have a lot of people who come are, you know, old Paris hands. They love France. They've gone many times. They just want a different angle to go with Aimé Leduc and find the bodies.
How do you apply for one of these trips?
Sure. It's October 6th. So go to my website, carablack.com, go to Paris trips and just look at it. And it'll tell you everything we're going to do, the lovely little French hotel we stay at. You know, we have breakfast together in the mornings. Every evening we have wine and cheese, talk about the day, talk about the book, where we're going to eat dinner, you know, things mm-hmm. like that. So, you know, there's a lot of time together. There's time apart, you know. It's kind of a nice trip. We don't call it a tour.
How many people get to go?
About 10 people. We figure that's a nice max, uh-huh. you know. And and just last night at my reading, we had several people who came on the trip with me in last October come. So a lot of people come and they tell their friends. It's like a girlfriend's trip, or yeah. you can come alone and have companionship if you wish. But Libby, can I say one thing?
Sure.
Also, so my publisher, Soho Press, is giving away the four scarves that I handpicked in Paris at Galerie Lafayette.
Ah.
So, yes, yeah. handpicked by moi. And and if you purchase the new book, Bel Air, all you need to do is take a picture of the receipt or order on your phone and email it. And there's all the information on my website or Soho's website. And then you're entered into a contest. So Friday and four Fridays, we're going to be giving away one of the French scarves I bought. And they're gender neutral, okay?
Even better. Excellent. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, Cara, thank you so much for spending time on Second Sunday Books before you fly off into the yonder. I wonder about the yonder. Never mind, that didn't quite work.
Book tour.
Yeah. Anyway, I hope that listeners have enjoyed this. I certainly did. It's always wonderful to talk to an old friend and see what she's been up to. And you have been listening to Second Sunday Books, which is part of Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm Libby Hellman, and I will be back again next month with another installment of Second Sunday Books.